Welcome back, everybody. We've been gone for a couple of weeks for our winter break, and I was really happy to be assigned today's Dharma talk because I thought it's going to be a really interesting morning at MCMC, and it has been. You know, after 45 years of doing this one way, we've become so consistently well attended that we've been bursting at the seams on Sunday. And so starting this week, after a lot of planning on the part of a lot of people, working out all the logistics, starting today we're going to have meditation and a Dharma talk and tea twice. And, you know, no matter how carefully we plan things, all kinds of unexpected things will happen, and we make a few adjustments. And, you know, I've been consciously over the past couple of weeks trying not to speculate about what today was going to be like and, you know, go into that, oh, have they thought about this? You know, is this going to happen? What about that? I've been just trying not to do that because I have that kind of brain. And, but it's tiresome doing that, and it's not helpful. And so I've been trying not to speculate as a spiritual practice. And so far, it's been great. So coming up with the topic for my talk today was easy. I'm going to talk about change. Change, as we call it in Buddhism, a lot of times we call it impermanence. And impermanence was deeply, deeply embedded in the core teachings of Buddhism. In the earliest sutras, it's right there in the middle of everything. It's right there in the middle of it, of what Buddhism is all about. It's what started Buddha on his spiritual quest. You know, he saw an old person and a sick person and then a corpse. And he said, you know, how do we live with this? How am I supposed to stay upright in the middle of this, in the middle of everything? Norman Fisher talked about this in an article I read recently. He said, as far as classical Buddhism is concerned, impermanence is the number one inescapable fact of life. It is the problem that our entire practice is meant to address. To understand impermanence at the deepest possible level is the whole of the Buddhist path. So by the end of this talk, so impermanence was there as an early teaching of the Buddha, and it was also there at the very end. His last words to the monks were, all conditioned things are impermanent. Strive on with diligence. That was the last thing. Imagine you have one last thing to tell these people that you've been with for 40 years. That's what he said. So that must have been what he really wanted them to remember. And we chant a variation on that every Tuesday, Saturday, and Sunday here at MCMC as part of the Bodhisattva vows. We chant Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. We're going to chant that at the end of the talk today, too. So Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. You know, every moment is a Dharma gate. Every moment. Things shift, and causes and conditions, you know, combine in different ways, and we have the opportunity in each of those moments to respond with care and with wisdom and with compassion. And it's a tall order. I almost hesitate to point it out because it's kind of daunting, you know, when we talk about it like that. So Katagiri, the founder of this place, said, be present from moment to moment right in the middle of the real stream of time. That gives you spiritual security. That gives you spiritual security. What does that mean? The Unitarians have a saying. They talk about having no ground to stand on. And when they do it, they hold their hand like this and move it. And the first time I ever heard it said, I was shocked, because that's pretty much the opposite of what I learned growing up. And, you know, they talked about it like it was a good thing. So, but I think what it means, or what it means to me at least, having spiritual security, it means that there's a spiritual practice involved in learning how to not turn away no matter what happens. No matter what happens, we can maintain a kind of lively interest and equanimity in what's going on. So in situations large and small, ranging from the slightly irritating things to the ones that we thought would have been completely untenable, you know, we can remain right here and remain engaged in it. And we'll talk about the how of that after a little bit. And I want to say that obviously change is not all bad. You know, sometimes it's a huge relief. Dogen once said that impermanence is Buddha nature. And what I think he meant by that, you know, it's in Fukan Zazengi. No, it isn't either. Forget it. He said that impermanence is Buddha nature, and by which I think he meant that it's a fact of life beyond our ideas and opinions. And it's more mysterious than we'll ever know, while also at the same time being completely ordinary. I was talking to my husband about this stuff last night. I was talking to him about, you know, the Buddhist take on change and impermanence. And he said, oh, yeah, I know about that because, you know, Buddhists are well known for just accepting everything and going with the flow. And, you know, whatever happens is okay. And I thought, we've been married 37 years. And, you know, has he not noticed that when he goes off at the refs in the football game and starts yelling at the TV as if they can hear him, has he not noticed that my response to that has not been passive acceptance in every moment? When I talked about completely untenable, that's what I meant. So, you know, I need to make the disclaimer that I thought went without saying, that this does not mean that we sit by on our little bliss clouds and go like, everything is perfect just as it is. You know, all is emptiness. Enlightenment pervades the universe, so I can sit here, you know, in the lotus position and just take whatever goes by. It doesn't mean that. That's falling into the trap of getting caught in the absolute. So what I'm talking about is training ourselves to pay a kind of lively attention to what's going on and maintaining our balance and equanimity while we respond to whatever's happening now. So no matter if somebody's yelling at the TV screen in the other room, even though their Buddhist wife has stated many times that she doesn't like it, or if it's somebody using their national platform to espouse racial stereotypes and stir up the worst instincts in humankind, we don't stand idly by, because there's work to be done. I was at a talk, I think it was in about early 2000s, somebody asked a visiting teacher if their practice could include going to a protest march. They were going to go to a protest march that was about President Bush and the second Iraq war. And the answer the teacher gave was that, yes, you can go, but see if you can do it without holding any hatred in your heart. So there's another tall order. So not standing idly by, but remembering that all of our activities are nothing other than practice. Nothing other than practice. Even going to a protest march. That kind of changed protest marches for me. But lately I've noticed that an unusual number of my reactions to things that I read in the news and hear about is, well, we have to smash the patriarchy. I've been saying that a lot lately. Anyone who can observe what's going on these days in a number of different areas, you know, who can watch that without being angry or you know, at least disturbed. I don't know. I don't know. I do believe that we're starting to see some of the most problematic effects of the patriarchy, you know, being dismantled. And as Buddhists, our part in that has to be making our contributions mindfully with all the compassion and kindness and courage and, you know, whatever we can muster up. It's not always easy, but that's our charge. Talking about smashing the patriarchy is why I have the statue up here today. I thought, I can't say smashing the patriarchy without having Mahabhachapati up here. She's Buddha's stepmother and the founder of the Order of Women Monastics. And in her own way, she did a little patriarchy smashing in her time. So that's why she's there. And she's got that great little smile on her face because she knows what she did. So Shunryu Suzuki, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, said, "Zen is making your best effort in every moment forever." And some days that's a really tall order. What you have to do is not think about the forever part. Just think about this moment right here. Forever will take care of itself if you take care of this moment. So how do we learn to deal with all the changes and issues that life presents with some level of equanimity? You know, I think we need a spiritual practice. I think everybody needs a spiritual practice. And ours here is Zazen. And, you know, we do Zazen without any expectation of achieving something special, right? But I have noticed that something different happens after you've done, once you've had a pretty good long history of doing Zazen. We used to, for a few years, at the end of Rahatsu Sesshin, which is a 7-day retreat that we do here early December every year, and for a few years there, the last night of the retreat, we'd go for a mindfulness walk along the lake. And it was pretty wonderful. You know, we'd do this mindfulness walk, and after sitting for 7 days, our minds would be really expanded, but also really attuned to the tiny things that were going on. So we'd walk along and really notice how beautiful it is out there. And the Christmas decorations that were up were just fantastic. And so you'd be in this sort of, wow! But also, if there was somebody standing, you know, who was walking alongside of you, you really notice sort of where they were at. You know, if they seemed sad or something, you really notice that. You really notice the particular lights on the other side of the lake. So, you know, Zazen teaches us to notice the sky, but also to notice what's right here in front of us. There's actually only one Dharma talk, you know, and it's Zazen, Zazen, Zazen. One of these days I'm gonna sit down up here and just go, do Zazen every day. Thank you very much. If I have to say it over and over for 30 minutes, I'll do that. Seriously, I'm going to do that one of these days, but not today. The Zazen instructions, when I give them, get simpler and simpler all the time. You know, just sit up straight, straighten your spine, you know. 3 points of contact with the ground. So for me right now, it's my two legs and my bottom. That way you're stable. And then put your eyes in kind of a soft gaze forward. Put your hands in the cosmic mudra. And that's it. That's it. There's nothing more than just your presence, or just there's nothing more than presence, and that's being Buddha. But if being Buddha is just too big for you to think about, you can just think about it as sitting with presence. Don't think about what it would be like to become enlightened. You know, don't worry about that. It'll take care of itself. Just sit there in the posture. Nothing else. There's no good zazen. There's no bad zazen. Although I've heard many, many people tell me that their zazen is terrible. I've never heard anybody say, I have the best zazen ever. Why is that? But I've heard a lot of people tell me they have terrible zazen, and there just is no such thing. You know, if you think it's terrible because your mind has been, you know, racing or drifting off, if your mind just drifts off, just come back to presence. Don't stop and beat yourself up. Just come back to presence. And one thing that'll happen over time is that within your zazen practice, you'll start noticing maybe a little gap in between when the thought arises and you're starting to follow it along. You know, you'll notice a little gap between when you go, when you start noticing a feeling and you start reacting to it. And once you start doing that on the cushion, you'll start noticing it in the rest of your life too. So, for example, somebody makes you angry or perturbed, you know, you can notice what's rising in you. And there's a possibility then of responding from a place of presence rather than reactivity. So, Fukan Zazengi, the one I was bringing up before, universal recommendations for zazen. Dogen said, think not thinking. It's one of his more well-known but obscure instructions. And I've heard a lot of different interpretations of what that means. And some of them very sure. This is exactly what Dogen meant. I never say that because I have no idea what Dogen meant. I just know, you know, what I'm thinking about what he meant today. But to me, think not thinking means don't go down the rabbit hole, don't go down that path of believing and reacting to all of your thoughts, all of your conditioned patterns. You know, it's so easy to go from, there's a little draft in here, to I'm feeling kind of cold, and I'm really sick of winter, and then you just keep taking it along, you know. But this is a really nice winter. It's a good winter. It's not so bad this year. But on the other hand, it's probably because of global warming. But I'm on the side of the good guys because I have an electric car. On the other hand, I took a plane to Pittsburgh last fall, so that's bad because plane travel is like one of the worst countries, blah, 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 and you're gone, right? And you're gone. And sometimes you're gone for a long time, but it's possible to train yourself to either notice that when it starts, or notice it when you get to Pittsburgh, or notice it, you know, at some point, and then come back. And maybe even notice it in that gap when it's first arising, when all it is a feeling and not sort of a commentary on the feeling. The feeling's not bad. Sometimes I am chilly. The thing that we're trying to avoid doing is just following the train of thought. So, doing that on the cushion is a wonderful thing, but to me, if it doesn't translate to your life off the cushion, what are you doing here? I want to see how our practice is off the cushion as well as on the cushion. On the cushion is easy compared to our practice when we're in traffic, you know? Or when we're in a meeting and somebody's in your face and they're saying things to you, you know? Maybe you can notice that little gap before the angry word comes out. Or maybe right after the angry word comes out and you have time to either make amends or correct yourself or something. But I think the key thing with Zazen isn't to have a nice, calm mind all the time. Although, you know, that's wonderful, but it's learning how to notice what's happening at any point and respond appropriately. Or from, well, appropriately and from a place of presence, of being Buddha. That takes a long time. Nobody wants to hear that. It takes a long time. But it will show up in your life. It will. So Paula Arai, who is wonderful, she was here a number of years ago. You remember her, right? Wasn't that incredible? If you ever get the chance to see Paula Arai speak, she used to be Ted's neighbor. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In Northfield.
And she's just as wonderful when she's not speaking to a group of Buddhists, I'm guessing.
She is. She's great.
Yeah. So anyway, she wrote a book called Women Living Zen, and it's mostly about Zen nuns in Japan. One of the things that she said was, practices acting, being, sitting, sleeping. And it's when these daily activities are done in accord with the Buddhist teachings that mundane actions become practice. And that's the thing I'm interested in, mundane actions, the most forgettable actions, the actions that take up most of our lives when those become practice. So when right in the middle of change, right in the middle of impermanence, right in the middle of, I don't remember what time this Dharma talk started, so now I don't remember what time it's supposed to end. Right in the middle of any of those things, even the chaos that goes on in your mind, then we can respond and we can act in a way that reflects the teaching and the practice. We can have that presence. We can actually be Buddha. So that's what I want to say about change this morning. Does anybody else want to say something about change or want to change the topic or anything? I used to go to a retreat on New Year's Eve at St. Paul's Monastery with the Benedictine nuns out there, and they called it Crossing the Threshold, and we'd talk about what our life the last year has been, but more importantly, what we wanted to do in this year. And I told Sister Carol about it one time. That's a whole lot like Dharma gates, except our Dharma gates are like every moment, which delighted her. She really liked it. So she's probably stolen it. But I stole Lectio Divina from them and turned it into Sitting with Sutras here. So, hi. Yeah.
This is kind of tangential, but like there's like these slogans that people get to saying, like, you've got your MAGA people and you've got your Smash the Patriarchy people.
Yeah.
It always feels like these weird slogans are like just a source of like conflict to me.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, like, could you speak about that? Like, how do you process these slogans in a way that's not inciting conflict in yourself or in the world?
Yeah. Well, we're not doing such a good job of it as a society, are we? I think one thing that really helps, it helps me when I can remember to do it, is to see that person as Buddha, and also to not say anything about them that is demeaning, you know? I mean, it helps to not think it, but at least don't say it, don't perpetuate it. And even to try to imagine where that comes from. I think we all have family members who disagree with us a lot on all kinds of different topics. And you're like, but that's Cousin Paul, and I love Cousin Paul. Well, you know, everybody's Cousin Paul. Which is a good thing most of the time. He's great. But Yeah.
Kind of a lot of times I was connecting with her this morning, and we had been talking with our daughters while they were visiting and reviewing some of the Buddhist teachings through the book Kindness.
Oh, Sharon Salzberg's book?
Yeah.
So
Buddhist stories for children.
Oh.
And there was one that came up again yesterday about the farmer who has these things happen, and his neighbor comes over and says, you know, congratulations on X, Y, and Z.
Oh, yeah.
He says, well, that's either good or bad. We don't know. And he either comes to congratulate him or to give him his sorrow. Like, we're sorry that happened to your family. And he says, it's neither good nor bad.
Yeah.
We don't know what will come of it.
Yeah. And then a whole chain of things happens. You know, the thing that somebody thought was good turns out to be bad, and then they're talking to him about, oh, I'm so sorry that happened, and he says the same thing. And then that turns out to be...
You never know what all of this means, and that's helpful. And putting that in perspective to say, let's just see what comes of this, but still don't respond.
Yeah. Remember when Barack Obama was elected and we all said, this means we're living in a post-racial society. Well, you know, turned out not to be the case, but it really shone a light on it, didn't it? You know? And now we see it, sort of, a little bit. Oh. Yeah, Carrie.
Thanks. I think this is a wonderful topic to keep reviewing all the time, because it feels to me like the basics, right? And yet it's not basic. It's simple. Right? I've noticed that, you know, I'm at a place in my practice and awareness where I can be very aware that I am reacting, right? But I can't. Well, I choose not to stop myself. No, it's not that I can't stop myself. It's that I choose not to stop myself, and then I struggle with kind of the aftermath of that, you know, because then after I sit with all that, and I, you know, I can come to this place of amends or showing up in a better way, changing my behavior so that I, you know, I'm not reacting in that same situation. And yet, a lot of times there's something there, right? There's something that's either doesn't feel just or like I'm not setting right boundaries for me. I mean, so I guess what I'm saying is, it seems like sometimes that choosing to react sometimes helps me to discover that there's some underlying thing that I need to sit with more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I first started practicing, one thing that I noticed people said a lot was, this practice will help you see more clearly. And I didn't really trust that, because I didn't know what it meant. What do you mean, see more clearly? And I can't explain it any better than they did, but you do see more clearly. I think because we're paying attention, we're learning how to pay attention. You know, and even if you don't respond in every moment in a way like you should, at least you're noticing it and thinking about it, you know, and contemplating it, and maybe next time, you know, or even that noticing it changes something inside, I think. Yeah. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, a number of, several years ago, my son was going away to college, and his first year of college, he went to Naropa College in Boulder, Colorado, which is a small Buddhist-inspired college, is the way they call it. And I went out to visit him about, that towards the end of the first semester. And I wanted to know how his classes were going, and I asked him, and he said, "Well, you know, that if you ever don't know the answer to something around here, you just say impermanence."
Not always so. That's a good one. I wish I had had that. In of course, nobody. You have to be in a crowd that understands that, right? That helps. We were in a crowd that understood different things when I was in college. That's wonderful. Imagine going to Naropa for college, being in that kind of milieu. That'd be amazing. So, yeah.
I just want to offer some thoughts about the slogan that was brought up earlier. I think they're useful in that, and they don't have to cause conflict inside you. But the way they're useful is that if you think about all the things that are behind them, like smash the patriarchy, what's really behind that is the idea that in our leadership, we need a more integrated leadership that reflects everyone. And so there's not really, smash the patriarchy is a dynamic way of quickly, conveying all that information. And I think with Make America Great Again, if you think about that, you think about what is the agenda behind that, are we being informed, are we being manipulated, it brings up all this stuff for us not to do like this about, but to consider.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, something is trying to be conveyed. What is being conveyed?
Yeah. Yeah. Where is this coming from?
To say, "Hi, how are you?" Well, I want to tell you about patriarchy.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't bring up smash the patriarchy in conversation very much. But, in the last couple of years, it's been a big topic. And early on, my husband and I were sitting around talking, and I spent, I think, about an hour just telling him stories of things that had happened to me and things that some of them I'd completely forgotten about, and he had no idea what it was like to be a young woman in corporate America and having, this happen and that happen. And he had no idea. So I think having those kind of conversations, when I go to visit my relatives, sometimes, you hear where the Make America Great Again is coming from.
Right.
Yeah.
The juxtaposition between your smash the patriarchy and your soft, lovely, singing voice. And you talk about the subject. And one practice that I try and do is I have a couple friends who are very angry about what's happening in our country and with good reason, but they post a lot of inflammatory and degrading things about our president and about others on social media. So one of the choices that I choose to make is not to respond to those posts. My first response is, just go, but that's not kind, and that's not right.
Yeah.
Right intention, right thought. So, this will give encouragement to when people express something that's still right speech, still kind.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, don't ask.
Yeah. I have one friend who I love dearly. We've been friends since high school, and you know, we've reconnected because of Facebook, but all he ever posts is really angry diatribes that I agree with but don't like the way he's saying them, you know? Delete, 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 delete. I miss him. I wish he'd tell me something about his life, you know? Yeah.
I'll show you the function where you can stay friends but unfollow.
I need to do that, don't I?
So, I have a family friend who has, she's sort of in the wacko direction. So, conspiracy theories, and it's like, how can you really possibly believe that? And she always wants to, you know, share these with me. And finally, I said, you know, I really don't think we should talk about politics because we're never going to agree. And she said, oh, okay. And then she started sending me pictures of flowers in her garden.
Nice.
So all she wanted to do was connect with me. And this, you know, spewing stuff at me was just trying to connect with me.
Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, people you love, just find there's another way to connect with them.
Yeah. 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 I have an aunt who told me that the reason that she didn't vote for the person she didn't vote for president was this one issue. And she said, I don't care about everything else, that one issue. And when she said that, I mean, that made, you know, I went, well, I can see that if that's the most important issue to you, that's why you wouldn't vote for them. And that was useful information for me, and it was helpful. Yeah. And then we didn't talk about it. Because, why talk about it? Yeah. Yeah, John.
I've been thinking about a lot lately is all of the divisiveness in all of our platforms with social media and just the anger and volume. I think of young people and teenagers and people in their 20s that are growing up seeing this. And it's a whole different reality than what I certainly experience, and so I just want to encourage this to be there for young people, and we're setting an example with our way of interacting, and they're watching us, you know. So my two cents worth.
Yeah.